Hi, I'm Nathan Weinbender, film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, part-time intrepid driver on I-90.
And I'm Dan Webster, also film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that doesn't mind traveling across the state if it means seeing lots and lots of movies of all kinds. That's what we did last week when we ventured to the 52nd Annual Seattle International Film Festival, or SIFF, a morning-to-night cinematic smorgasbord that, this year, ran 11 days, took over 4 theaters around the city, and included more than 100 features and nearly 100 shorts from every corner of the world. Over the years, the three of us have attended film festivals in all sorts of locales: Park City, New Orleans, Kosovo, Florence, and, of course, right here in Spokane. But Seattle will be our setting today, and between us, we saw more than 20 individual titles in the SIFF lineup. We did a SIFF preview a couple weeks ago before we actually went to the festival, but now that we've been and returned, we'll talk about what we saw. But first, let's talk about the experience of actually attending SIFF this year.
Well, the festival has definitely scaled back from earlier years, and I think that SIFF itself had some challenges over the past year financially and so forth, but I believe that they've hit a reset button now. And I'm drawing that conclusion not only from the size of the festival, but also they didn't have any individualized SIFF merch for me. So I was a little disappointed there.
You were looking.
I was, yeah. But the good news, I think, is the fact that the locations for the fest are primarily centered in the Seattle Center area, and so it's easy to get around.
A lot easier than it was years ago when we would go north to the Neptune in the University District and go
over to
the Pacific
Wallingford
Place
exactly. Downtown and. But I must say, I really miss the Egyptian. That was always the highlight of past festivals. And it went through its own sort of renovation process, and a variety of things happened subsequently. But yeah, so it's convenient to do the fest in its current incarnation.
Yeah, and probably regular moviegoers probably would not really care about the differences. But on those days in which it was 25 days long and had more than, say, 300 movies from countries all over the world, it was a different experience. But we don't have to stand in line for hours anymore. Pretty much every time we got in within a few minutes. So it's a much more usable and navigable festival now.
And of course, we're always shouting out a variety of volunteers. And I have to say that everyone is always super pleasant, super friendly, super helpful.
Yeah.
And I always enjoy the commentary by the programmers for the fest.
Yeah,
and I always go over there without a car, so it's really nice to be able to just, you know, hop on the light rail, hop on the monorail, get from one place to another, and not miss the movies, because that used to be a problem back in the day.
Well, yeah, you'd have to go back and forth.
So let's talk about some actual movies, what do you say?
Because movies.
So we were over there at the same time and saw some things, the three of us, together, so I thought we would start with some of those. And I have to say, before we get going, I thought it was a really strong year for documentaries at SIFF this year. I saw mostly nonfiction films. And almost all of them were really worth seeing. So let's start with one that I think I was most excited for, which is called Borman and the Devil. We saw this at the Downtown Theater. And the title refers to the director, John Borman. And it's a documentary tracing the production of his 1977 film, Exorcist II, The Heretic.
Which it was originally supposed to be just The Heretic, but
Because The Exorcist was, you know, what it was, they made it The Exorcist II. And William Peter Blatty had a similar problem with Exorcist III a few years later, but that's for another show. This is an incredibly niche subject because this is one of the most exhaustive behind-the-scenes filmmaking documentaries I've ever seen. David Kittredge is the director. He gets seemingly everyone he possibly can to sit down. He's talking to script supervisors, camera operators, assistant directors. He finds the guy that was inspecting all of the locusts that they used on the production. He talks to Linda Blair, the late Louise Fletcher, and Borman himself. And if you know anything about Exorcist II, it's one of the most famous bad movies of all time. And a bunch of the people are saying so much craft went into this film, but we knew that it was cursed from the very beginning. So if you are in the niche audience for this sort of thing, this is a really fun movie. And actually, I think I came away appreciating The Exorcist 2 more than I did going in, which I, admittedly I didn't appreciate it much going in, but it's a fascinating subject.
Yeah, it was a failed effort for sure. And so many different things went wrong in The Exorcist 2. And we get to hear about a lot of them. And probably the most entertaining person I found was the late Louise Fletcher.
Yeah.
Because she just was getting a kick out of being interviewed and so forth. And actually, I thought Linda Blair was very thoughtful about mm-hmm. different things that had happened as well. Yeah. And Borman revived his career.
Yeah, with Excalibur. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
And this almost ended his career, yes. The Exorcist 2. And we should note that it was nominated for the Best Documentary at the Venice Film Festival.
Borman and the Devil.
And
was.
Some people will, to this day, call it a masterpiece, while others say it's an abortion. So let's move on to your second one on this list, Buck's Harbor, which I think is a film that surprised all of us because it 5 years in the making, the director, Peter Mueller, did exactly what all good documentary filmmakers have to do. He found the right characters. Dave Kincaid, Mark the Lobster Fisherman, Wayne, this tough guy clam digger. And he just follows them and gives a feel for what it's like to grow up in this small coastal Maine village. And it never goes overboard. It just gives you a feel for what it's like living there. And I really liked it. I can't say enough about it.
But it's not just like a slice of life, fly on the wall kind of movie. I mean, it is that. But this film, Buck's Harbor, is also ultimately, and it kind of slowly reveals what it's really getting at, it's ultimately a movie about how boys are raised to be men, specifically mm-hmm. in these rural communities. And we see all these different versions of manhood, I suppose, and it's both painful and illuminating and fascinating. I mean, the one guy who has seen so much death and disappointment and addiction in his life, and he's trying to come out on the other side and, you know, become a harbor master. I mean, he would be enough for one documentary. Then you have the guy who runs the bait shop in town, who's like secretly recording TikToks in drag,
yes,
in
yes.
his house. You know, he's got on his wig and his thigh-high boots and is kind of keeping that a secret from the rest of this, you know, macho community. It's really fascinating. And yeah, the director clearly enmeshed himself mm-hmm. in this community because they obviously trusted him because they spill their guts on
yes.
camera.
Yeah.
Well, and apparently the director, Peter Mueller, was at our screening and he talked about filming this over the course of 5 years. One of the questions that Dan asked was about the music. So Dan, maybe you can elaborate on that just slightly.
Yeah, because I think the music, and as Nathan was reminding me, he used at a couple of points some standard old tunes like Rockin' Robin. But I was most impressed with the long sequences without any music at all. I asked him about that and he was saying that, well, talk to the composer and we just decided it worked better without it. And it really did.
Yeah, good instinct.
Another question that was asked, are there any stories that you had to leave on the cutting room floor? And the director indicated that was the most painful part of this because he had done so much filming. And he talked specifically about one individual whose story he wanted to tell, but it just wouldn't fit with the remainder of the narrative, despite how compelling it was.
Right. And we were talking about the documentary Buck's Harbor. But before we take a break here, I think we need to get to two films that both have a legal aspect to them. Case 137, a narrative French film, which bases on a real case, and When a Witness Recants, which is an extremely powerful documentary about a crime that happened, a murder that happened in, 40 years ago in Baltimore, Maryland.
1983, yeah. I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So, MP, you're our legal expert.
I was really eager to see When a Witness Recants, and I actually tried to get a screener ahead of time. And I'm sure this will be released because HBO is now behind the project. But it really is the story of these three youths in Baltimore who were accused and then ultimately convicted of killing a schoolmate. And it basically tells there was not any physical evidence. There were some conflicting witness accounts about what happened. But we get the impression from the very beginning that they were unfairly accused. And of course, we learn fairly early on that they were ultimately exonerated. But the focus is on this guy who had originally, you know, sort of made up this story with the law enforcement encouragement about what he had seen. And it's based on a short story that was written in The New Yorker a few years before that. And it's I was mesmerized by it because it focuses on all the individual exonerees as well as the witness who recants and other players in this particular scenario.
And that movie has a coda that will, like, knock the wind out of you. Oh, boy. And that was the first half of our look at the recent Seattle International Film Festival. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Dan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to continue the SIFF discussion. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Hey, this is Steve Inskeep. One of the things you can count on from NPR and this station, we've got your back when it comes to reporting the news, bringing you facts you can count on. And one thing this station counts on is contributions to keep it going. You can help by donating a vehicle you no longer need, which is free to you, easy to do, and could mean hundreds of dollars worth of support. Thanks.
Visit spr.careasy.org from your driveway to the airwaves.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Nathan Weinbender. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Dan Webster, and I were talking about the 52nd annual Seattle International Film Festival, and we'll pick up where we left off. We mentioned the French film Case 137 in the first half of the show. Why don't we start there, MP?
This is a film about a police investigator. So our star, Leah Drucker, is an investigator, internal affairs investigator. We would refer to that person's role in the U.S. And a boy has been wounded during the street protests. All of the law enforcement officers who were in the vicinity disclaim any sort of knowledge about what transpired. And gradually she pieces together with the help of a witness what had transpired. I liked this film. I'm not saying it's exactly Spiral or one of the police procedurals out of France, and maybe that's a good thing. I would say the denouement was a little disappointing, or maybe the last sequence. I thought the acting was good. It was a serious subject, and of course it related to all the hurdles in criminal procedure in France.
Yeah, I wasn't disappointed at all. I didn't mind the ending at all. Leah Drucker is so good in this film, and it's based upon a real case. It's a fictionalized version of that. It's a narrative film, not a documentary like some of the others that we've been talking about. But I just thought it was a dynamite movie.
Yeah, I agree with what you said, MP, about Case 137, that there's a monologue that the Leah Drucker character has near the end that I thought laid out the movie's themes a bit too obviously. Felt like there was a logical endpoint in the story. There's a confrontation between her and the kid's mother that felt like it could have been a real gut punch of an ending. But it is still a pretty absorbing procedural. I will give you that. I'll go with something that's a little less serious because I did go to the SIFF opening night gala where they were playing the new Boots Riley film, I Love Boosters, and Boots was there. It was good to see him. He wore this really cool, like, Dr. Seuss blue cowboy hat that I might get one for myself. A little asterisk on this, though. It was at the Paramount Theater, and I don't think I've ever heard a worse sound mix for a movie screening in my entire life. Mm. And I'm not alone. I went online, and people were complaining about this.
That didn't used to be the case. I mean, we've seen concerts there.
It's oh, a well, but I mean, a movie's different than a concert.
Sure,
and
sure.
I think they mixed it like a concert, yeah. And it did not work. Most of the dialogue was really hard to hear. But somehow I still enjoyed the movie because it is so loud and colorful and just packed with cartoonish sight gags, stop motion animation.
And the ensemble cast.
Oh, yeah. It's Kiki Palmer and Naomi Ackie and Taylor Page and Demi Moore, Will Poulter. Lots of fun people in this. So the way I've been describing I Love Boosters is It's like if Almodovar's Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown was
one
set,
of my favorites.
Was set inside Pee-wee's Playhouse. So if that sounds like it's up your alley, it probably will be. It's coming out in theaters, so see it in a real movie theater, unlike I did. But I still had a good time with it. I'm going to go back and see it again with a better sound mix.
Nathan, thanks for that information, because we've seen the trailers and I was looking forward to it. So I'm going to talk briefly about Salvation, which is a Turkish film directed by Emin Alper. And it basically, again, is inspired by, based on a true story about something that happened in the mountainous regions of rural Turkey. And there were two sort of clans that had occupied the same territory. One clan had left, and now it's returned. And the focus is really not only on the conflict between these two clans, but this intra-family conflict among two brothers, one of whom was left in charge of the village and was the spiritual leader designated the heir by the grandfather.
Even though he was the younger brother.
Yeah, and he was the younger brother. And now his older brother is starting to realize that maybe the sort of peaceful, more peaceful approach that his younger brother is taking is not working for the villagers and so forth. But it's a gut punch of a movie, I think, throughout. There's magical realism. The acting is superb. And at a couple points, I actually said to Dan, that looks like a painting. I mean, mm-hmm. It was filmed so beautifully.
Yeah. I would say if there's a problem with the film, it's that it telegraphs what is going to be the ending midway through. So when the ending comes, you go, oh, yeah, I saw that. But it ultimately is a terrific movie. And it was based upon a 2009 massacre of a bunch of people in this small village.
What was the title of that one again?
Salvation.
Salvation. I'll be looking for that one.
Yeah, and you know, if you go on IMDb, there's about 20 films called Salvation. So yeah. It's Salvation 2026. That's how you have to look for it. Let's get back to documentaries. I wanted to talk about the documentary called American Doctor. It's about three American doctors, one who is a Jewish American guy, one who is born in the United States, but of parents who were Palestinian, and then the third doctor.
Is Indian.
Is Indian, yes.
East
and
Indian.
So two of them actually go to Gaza to work to do medical procedures, I mean, on the people being bombed by the Israeli army. The third one, the guy who has Palestinian roots, can't even get into the country.
He had been there previously.
Yes, but he
could not return.
During this movie, it shows his struggle to get back because he can't get the final okay to get back in. And so it goes back and forth, showing us a lot of horrible, horrible sights of what's going on in Gaza, and at the same time then showing how these people are all working to bring attention to the crisis there.
And the filmmaker did appear for a Q&A as well. So that's one of the benefits of going to these festivals,
yeah,
that you can hang out. Sometimes people ask some questions that are a little odd, but...
Yeah.
Oh, are you looking at me? No,
I wasn't. Okay, well, I'm just... not the king of segues on this show, because I'm also going in a completely different direction with the next movie I want to talk about, which is a narrative film called Power Ballad. This is the newest film from director John Carney, who often blends music and comedy and romance in movies like Once.
Oh, Once, one of the great movies. Oh.
So great. Also did Sing Street. And this movie, which I think comes out in early June, so it will be playing in theaters, stars Paul Rudd as a guy who long ago had aspirations of being a great rock star and now somewhere in his 40s or 50s is fronting a wedding cover band in Ireland. And at one of his gigs, he meets one of the wedding guests who happens to be a huge pop star played by real huge pop star Nick Jonas, who has just come out of a boy band and is trying to legitimize himself as an artist. And the two of them have like a bonding session. They drink, they play music, and they have a good time. And then months later, Paul Rudd hears a song on the radio that sounds an awful lot like one of the songs he wrote and showed to the Nick Jonas character. And sure enough, he stole the song and took it to the top of the charts. And so the movie is sort of about his identity sort of being in question because he doesn't know what he's doing anymore. And he has this crisis of conscience. And I got to say, this movie, Power Ballad, it's not corny. I'll say it that way. There are moments in this movie where I rolled my eyes. I mean, it's called Power Ballad, and it's about a guy whose last name is Power who writes a ballad. And I thought, yeesh. Yeah. But Carney has this way of making these very light-as-a-feather stories have an actual emotional resonance. And I still enjoyed this, despite the fact that I was rolling my eyes here and there. So if you like Carney's other stuff, you'll probably like Power Ballad, too. So keep an eye out for that.
And of course, I'm going to go back to a documentary, which Dan and I saw and had some different reactions to. But the documentary was titled Soul Patrol. And it tells the story of the Army's only black LRP team. So
Long Range Reconnaissance Patrol, LRP.
So these were folks who were usually in patrols of five or six plop behind enemy lines and were, you know, trying to do some reconnaissance, surveillance, and so forth.
In the Vietnam War, right?
During the Vietnam War, yes. And so maybe that's where Dan's and my perspectives differed a little, because he actually experienced that up close and personal, the Vietnam War.
I wasn't a LRP.
Okay.
Far from it.
Okay. Okay, but you did drive those River Patrol boats.
That's true. Know? It was directed by J.M. Harper, and he won a Sundance Directing Award, but it was based upon a book by Ed Manuel. And Ed Manuel and several of the members of their team, it's like their last reunion. And so the problem I had with the film was that Harper insisted on doing recreations, which to me felt totally false. And I love the parts about the real guys and their recollections of what their experience was. But,
And they had great archival footage. And also these guys had used video cameras for their own purposes. Mm-hmm. And so they had a lot of that stuff, too.
Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, I think the message here is pretty clear, is that we saw a lot of good things this year. I didn't see any outright duds. So
I would call this year a success.
When a Witness Recants is a superb documentary, and I would not be surprised to see it as an Oscar nominee come this next year.
Keep an eye out. And with that, this is Movies 101. I'm Nathan Weinbender, and Dan Webster, Mary Pat Truthart, and I have been discussing our time at this year's Seattle International Film Festival. Let's take this moment to thank Aaron Bratt for directing the show. And we thank you too, our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, even if we have to travel for it. Until then, consider these words from Oscar winner Tilda Swinton. Film festivals are about film audiences and about giving an audience the encouragement to feel really empowered and to stretch the elastic of their taste. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.